This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday and time for the Week in Review.
I say, raise the flag!
Raise the flag!
Raise the flag!
Protesters there at Hampshire College over the weekend. The college had originally lowered the Stars and Stripes to half staff after the election, then removed it entirely after someone had burned it. Today, Hampshire College raised the flag once again. Here's college president Jonathan Lash.
The reaction to lowering the flag had become something of a toxic circus. Rather than facilitating that discussion, which we've started over the past week, it became a distraction.
However, Brian Martin of the Massachusetts Veterans of Foreign Wars says it's about more than just a discussion.
This is what men and women have died for. They've fought for this symbol.
Well, joining us now in the studio to talk about this story and the rest of the week's news is John Carroll, professor of communication at Boston University and WBUR senior news analyst. Hi there, John.
Hi, Meghna.
Also with us today is Zuri Berry. He's deputy managing editor for news and multimedia at the Boston Herald and co-host of Newsfeed on Boston Herald Radio. Zuri, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me. It's great to have you. So let's just dive right in here and just get your first initial thoughts from both of you on all that's been going on at Hampshire College, the decision to take the flag down, put it back up today, the protest that ensued. Zuri, you get first crack.
Well, I think there were a couple of mistakes made here on behalf of Hampshire College, the first being sort of the timing of the matter. And John, I would love to hear your take on this, but obviously having the idea to, one, as an expression of grief over violent deaths suffered in the country, take down and put the flag at half-mast or whatever may have you, to do that on November 9th, a date in which I believe immediately after the election, I think that was questionable in its own right. And then the second mistake being removing all flags after this incident of the flag burning, which I think is immaterial to the controversy here. I think those two mistakes were poor judgments on behalf of the administration and whoever was overseeing the flag in the first place.
Yeah, I think they framed this really badly. This could be a case study over at Harvard Business School of how not to handle public relations around a controversial issue. I think there are two stories about whether they removed all the flags or not. Mm-hmm. I think the one report said they did not remove all the flags from the campus. But this one was the central one. And I think that the aptly named Jonathan Lash really mishandled it in the beginning by labeling it, the flag, a disruptive symbol. I think that framed it in a way that was bound to draw protest and also set it up as a sort of confrontational issue. And he was asking for dialogue when he basically created an environment that didn't really foster dialogue. And he sort of reaped the results of that.
So let me just ask both of you. I mean, I have to say, we're in an interesting place where a college, an American college, looks at the United States flag, as you said, as a disruptive symbol. Because one of the questions I have now is, for students going there who felt troubled by seeing the flag, are they going to feel troubled? I was asking this of my staff. Anytime they board an airplane, because the airplane always has a flag on it, are they going to feel troubled anytime they have to look a U.S. soldier in the eye? I mean, what about the positive disruptions that the flag has also been a symbol of? I mean, Union soldiers in the Civil War marched under a version of the Stars and Stripes.
Right.
Yeah. I'm sorry, but I kind of feel like this is just sort of feeds into the sort of mentality that there are college students that need coddling, that cannot sort of handle any kind of or speech or thought that is counter to their own personal beliefs or anything like that. And I think that's possibly wrongheaded in this particular situation, because what you're finding is that there was a reaction to a flag burning. Again, I think overall immaterial to the situation at hand, but you have a mistake that occurs in putting this flag at half mast on November 9th, and there is this sort of aloofness as far as believing that this is not going to be connected with the results of the election, whether it was Donald Trump being victorious on November 8th or Hillary Clinton. I think that there would have been a problem and a reaction to that, and that is part of the problem here.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a big fan of the associate provost of coddling on campus, and I think that there were some tough lessons to be learned here, and I think that one of the problems was that nobody really framed it the way it should have been framed. When Jonathan Lash takes the flag down and says this is not a political act, That's dismissible out of hand. And I think the whole thing was political. And to deal with it that way was to deal with it in a forthright manner. And I think that they did not, and they tried to finesse it. And whenever you try to do that, or not whenever, very often when you try to do that, it blows
it
up in your face.
Yeah. I think there was some worthy skepticism that was necessary when he said that it was about, you know, all violent deaths across the world. I mean, I don't believe that went over well with people that thought that was actually the case, that's what he actually believed.
Yeah, no, that went over like the metric system. Yeah.
Well, let's hear a little bit from the protest that ensued over the weekend at Hampshire College about the removal of the flag. We've got some sound here, and in it you'll hear basically there were a group of veterans who were gathering at their protest site for a group photo. A counter-protester actually disrupted the photo. According to Mass Live, this counter-protester made some obscene gestures and then sat in silence, and then this happened.
His rights are first. Our rights are last. His rights are first. Arms are
perfect. I will not let anybody touch him. Okay?
But we're better than the other side.
But no one will touch him. This is why we fought, right?
So it's a little difficult to understand who's saying what, but early in that clip you heard a man chanting, his rights are first, our rights are last. That was an older veteran chanting that. And then later on in the clip you hear another veteran say no one will touch him, that he wouldn't allow any of the protesters to touch or disrupt the counter-protester. And he said, no one will touch him. This is why we fought, right? So, I mean, to me, right then and there, and that, there's a little microcosm of perhaps some good, I have to say, that's come out of this controversy, because we're seeing American citizens engaging in all of the rights that are also captured within the symbol of the American flag. The right to protest, the right to be upset about the protest, the right to defend protesters, right to protest.
Right, and the right to burn the flag.
Exactly.
Which you know, I'm not urging anybody to do, but that's one of the rights, too. And so it was all rolled up in a bundle, and it was there for what they call the teachable moment, nobody got taught very much because they were operating across purposes, and they were basically talking past each other, and that never brings any kind of enlightenment.
Well, I don't want to just poo-poo the idea that the symbolism of any flag, because flags are very, very potent symbols. I mean, you know, look at all that's happened around the Confederate flag and the stars and bars. But because of that, I mean, that's another reason why when on Tuesday, President-elect Donald Trump tweeted, quote, nobody should be allowed to burn the American flag. If they do, there must be some consequences, perhaps loss of citizenship or a year in jail. I mean, that caught everyone's attention right then and there.
Yeah, and obviously in a reaction to all of this. And I would say that we're going to continue to have an argument about how we protest, because there is, and you've seen this with Black Lives Matter, you've seen this with Colin Kaepernick, as we talked about, and I'm sure you've addressed numerous times on this show, that people are always sort of criticizing these folks in the sense of, well, they shouldn't do it that way. They shouldn't protest in this manner, or they shouldn't protest against the flag, et cetera, et cetera. And there's no sort of consensus of what is the proper way to protest. And I think what folks are coming around to and sort of getting back to is that any sort of form of protest, even the most egregious and ugly version, which you could consider the flag burning being a part of that, is allowed and okayed under our rules in Constitution. And whether or not that is something that we all find agreeable, whether or not we want to criticize the act in its own right, I mean, that comes down later.
Right. You know, I want to move on to another story here in just a second, but we should acknowledge that Hampshire College President Jonathan Lash also told WBUR just this morning that in response to their decisions around the flag, that they were getting a lot of graphic threatening calls and emails. So kind of an also ugly side to this story. And he told WBUR he felt that it was just safer to put the flag back up. So again, we can question whether that decision was later than it should have been, but want to acknowledge that there was that aspect of the story, too. Okay, well, let's just move on here, if we can, and talk about legalized marijuana in Massachusetts, of course, voted into law vis-a-vis question 4 on November 8th. And I have to say, this has elicited what might be my favorite newspaper quote of the week, possibly even the last 4 weeks. It comes from our friend, Massachusetts Secretary of State Bill Galvin, who told The Globe on Monday, quote, All those tokers can hold their breath a little longer, but they'll be able to exhale by early 2017. Basically talking about how there may be some delays in enacting legalized marijuana. So first of all, John, let's start with you. Do you see a problem with the state delaying implementation?
I think they should delay it as long as they possibly can because they have no idea what they're doing. And really, I mean...
That's not an excuse.
It may not be an excuse, but it's a perfectly good strategy, I think. I think that they were handed a Rube Goldberg contraption of a ballot initiative that they have to sort out. I think that what's in the ballot initiative is going to be almost impossible to implement the way it's been presented.
Okay, so just let me jump in here because speaking of your Rube Goldberg contraption, we talked with State Treasurer Deb Goldberg who has to implement a lot, no relation. But she said, you know, there's all these obstacles that are, in her mind, standing in the way of smooth implementation of recreational marijuana. I mean, for example, funding the commission that's going to oversee legal marijuana sales. So here's what she told us.
As of this moment, if I were to hire an executive director and appoint the three commissioners, I have no way to pay them. You know, revenues don't start coming in till you issue the licenses.
But you need the commission first.
Right.
So where's the money going to come from?
That's a very good question.
Crickets followed after that.
Yeah. Well, I got to tell you, this is something that frustrates me completely. And I'm totally opposite of John here in this regard. I think they should just go ahead and implement it as is and continue to fix things as they go along, which is what they would normally do. Massachusetts has a rich history of failing to implement ballot initiatives. I think we all know how they messed up the medical marijuana portion. We're just now getting close to getting 5% tax rate in this state. And there are many other examples. And this sounds like it's going to go down that path of in which our elected officials, DeLeo Rosenberg and our treasurer, Deborah Goldberg, are all very much doing something that I would say is probably against the will of voters here. And that is usually being their inaction in one regard or another.
Well, not to get technical about it, but I don't think any voters actually read the ballot question.
I did.
Well, you did, but that's your job.
Yeah.
So a lot of people went in and they voted for the idea of legalization of recreational marijuana. I agree with you entirely that the legislature has been intransigent in too many instances where ballot initiatives have been passed. I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
But if you look at the implementation of the medical marijuana law, you see something that is so halting and so tentative in its implementation that I think they should take their time, not violate the spirit of the ballot initiative.
But taking their time, aren't they by definition violating the spirit and the letter of the initiative? I mean, a lot of this is supposed to get underway in 2 weeks.
Well, we can turn into California, where they just keep passing propositions that contradict each other and result in absurd law. An absurd implementation, but I think a little caution here is going to go a long way.
There are outs here in this legislation, if you read through them, that allow for municipalities to go to their voters or through their city councils and communities and make changes that they see fit that need to occur. And I think what we're going to see is that as the legislator, obviously they have to pay for the commissioners to implement this, but as the legislator figures out the fixes and the add-ons that they need to do, they need to understand that they should not just go against the will of the voters by delaying this any further, because it is very simple to say that Massachusetts voters wanted recreational marijuana, they wanted medical marijuana before, and because of the way that they handled things with medical marijuana, that's what led to this point in time now. I don't think that it would help Rosenberg, DeLeo, and the rest of the state representatives to somehow continue to push against this, whether it's Walsh or anybody else. I think every single elected official was against marijuana. I don't think it would help any of them in regards to their voters and the people that sort of want this to continue to delay and use these sort of tactics.
But Zuri, let me just jump in here because I take your point. But on the other hand, say the delay is, a couple of months or maybe even 6 months. I don't know, because there's different phases.
I have no patience for it. I'm just going to say it.
I get that, but what if that delay allows Deb Goldberg, DeLeo, Stan Rosenberg, yeah, everybody, the chance to really get it right for Massachusetts, so we don't really don't have a medical marijuana repeat. And then once,
so what does it
once
mean
sales
to
get off
right?
the ground, well, I mean, if you ask Deb Goldberg, she would say, like,
yeah,
having that IT backbone so that sales can go through, yeah, getting the excise tax at, yeah, at a rate that maybe is more.
So the issue
positive
that I have is that I believe that there are many industries within Massachusetts and other regulated, whether it's alcohol or otherwise, that you can sort of translate the regulations that are there and implement it there and sort of copy and paste, so to speak, so that way these things can be looked after and also implemented in a, yeah, timely manner. I don't believe it takes, especially with this going into effect in January 2018, I don't believe it will take more than that, particularly to get shops up and running.
Let me add one note. You know, we talk about the three commissioners on the Cannabis Control Commission, but they have to hire a whole army of other people to staff it. They need lawyers, they need accountants, they need tech people, the IT people, they need enforcement agents. I mean, the estimate is that this could cost $30 million to set this infrastructure up. Mm-hmm. So there's that. We're not talking about small dollars here, and we're not talking about a small bureaucracy either. We're talking about a pretty big bureaucracy. So I understand the impatience that people would have because of the delay, and maybe it's because of my advanced years. It seems to me that it would probably be worth it, but then again, essentially, I'm not one of the stakeholders here.
It does seem, though,
and I would also say that I'm not a stakeholder.
I'm not accusing you of anything, sorry.
I'm not, this is not an industry I would take part in personally or anything like that, and I know no one who would, actually. But my point being is that I think if the will of the voters say that this is something that they want and they've given this timeline through the legislation, I would assume that voters knew better.
Okay.
Sometimes that's a pretty big assumption.
Yeah, I mean, have you met voters?
Yeah. Okay. Let's not get all elitist now on the voters, please.
Just saying.
Oh my God. Oh, I think we might have actually deserved that, Zuri. Okay, so let's shift. Well, we're not really shifting gears that much, but let's talk a little bit more about politics and start with what happened just yesterday at Harvard's Institute of Politics, because they hosted their regular post-presidential election conference, and it's when they invite very top senior level members of both campaigns to Harvard to talk, give a sort of an inside view of what happened. This year, there was a lot of heated moments, such as this exchange between Donald Trump's campaign manager Kellyanne Conway and senior Clinton pollster Joel Benenson. Excuse me. He tried to make the point that though Donald Trump is president-elect, Hillary Clinton did win more of the popular vote.
Listen, you guys won. That's clear. You won the Electoral College. That's the currency.
That was
the
fight, right?
Let's also be honest. Don't act as if you have some popular mandate for your message. And Tony, we'll talk about the wrong track number again like you and I just did. The fact of the matter is that more Americans voted for Hillary Clinton than Donald Trump.
And here's how Kellyanne Conway responded.
Why is there no mandate? You've lost 60 congressional seats since President Obama got there. You lost more than a dozen senators, a dozen governors, 1,000 state legislators.
What about this election,
Kellyanne? You said there's no mandate.
So I'm just wondering briefly what you guys think about the fact that this particular fight, I mean, let alone across the nation, it still seems very much alive between senior levels of both campaigns.
Yeah, I understand they brought in food tasters during the lunch break. It's you know, this is a microcosm of the campaign itself. And I think that all the hot buttons and all the dog whistles and everything that happened during the campaign and every failing on the part of the Clinton team and every questionable tactic on the part of the Trump team is still in the air, and it's still being debated actively by the public and obviously by these campaign aides.
I think it's clear that Democrats, particularly those that are on the front lines, like those that were at the Harvard's Institute of Politics yesterday night, are very much viewing themselves as a resistance to this administration and the, I would say, Republican-led government at this point. And so I think when they start framing framing things as if there is a no mandate allowed for the Trump administration to go forth with its agenda, I think that's very much speaks from a point of resistance and also a point in which, you know, this is the last shot we have to fire here in order to sort of rally people on our side to say that, you know, we can't just, you know, walk or at least let these folks walk all over us for the next 4 years.
Mm. Well, I want to play one more piece of tape here because there's also the question of what's next for the Democratic Party as a whole. It's so funny because wasn't it like 6 months ago everyone was asking about what's the future of the GOP? Well, now it's what's the future of the Democratic Party? I mean, we're
still probably questioning both of those things.
Yeah, that's right. Next week we'll be talking about the GOP again. But we spoke with Congressman Stephen Lynch, and you know, earlier this week he was supporting Tim Ryan of Ohio for House Minority Leader. Nancy Pelosi ended up hanging on to that spot. But here's one of the things that Lynch pointed to us. He said that there's an underlying concern of many Democrats that there's a divide between party leadership and average Americans.
What Tim Ryan's candidacy is based on is that, you know, in young, you know, it's the difference between San Francisco and Youngstown, Ohio. And we're arguing that, you know, the economic struggles of average Americans is a unifying theme.
So, John, I mean, the difference between San Francisco and Youngstown or Boston and Youngstown?
There's two sort of dichotomies here that they were playing out in this process. One was the geographic one. The other was going for the money as opposed to going for the votes. And those charges were leveled at Pelosi and her management of the Democratic Party, her leadership of the Democratic Party. And the whole idea that they just turned their back on working people across the country and were spending their time, as one person said, at fundraisers as opposed to fish fries was something that really solidified it and galvanized this fight. And I think that's going to be the fight going forward. I think Nancy Pelosi is going to have a sort of a rocky road to go because there is a significant pushback from Democrats in the rank and file.
Zuri?
And this sort of continues the conversation about the messaging that comes out of Democrats right now, which is it going to be an economic one or is it going to be about identity politics? And is it going to be, again, catering to different minority groups in order to pull those coalitions together, which was thought to be the Obama coalition, in order to beat Republicans? And what we've seen, obviously, is that did not work overall, particularly with this candidate, Hillary Clinton. So it looks like the Youngstown, if I would say, argument of who this is, continue to go after the economic message and how we can help those people there. I think the negative attribution to San Francisco, I'm a San Francisco guy, is that all of a sudden we're only more concerned with the identity politics of everything, which is, I would say, the perception. I'll take it, but nonetheless, you understand where that messaging comes from.
Yeah. Well, this is definitely a discussion worth more exploration, and we'll keep having it in the coming weeks on the program. But I don't want to run out of too much time to have our hubbubs, because really, I mean, it's always good to end Friday on a lighter note, isn't it? So, John, your hubbub?
My hubbub is a new scientific study that just came out about the great Boston molasses flood of 1919, and they were trying to determine why it was so deadly. It was very deadly. There were 2 million gallons that flowed through the North End. 21 people were killed, 150 injured, and the American Physical Society did some testing, and they came to realize that partly it was the temperature that made it so deadly, because when it came out of the tank, it was going about 35 miles an hour. It had been heated for transport. When it hit the cold air, this is January, it hit the cold air, it started to solidify, and that's how people got trapped, and that's how people got drowned. So I think, kids, if you're listening at home, science is a wonderful thing, and you should pay more attention to it.
We're actually going to talk to some of those researchers next week, too, on the show, so thanks for the promo.
Excellent. Sure.
Zuri, your hubbub?
And my hubbub is about the Boston NAACP chapter. They just named a new president, Tanisha Sullivan. She had been running unopposed. She formerly worked as the chief officer in the Boston Public Schools Office of Equity, and she had been the one that signaled to administrators in early 2015 about the student bias complaints at Boston Latin School. So that hasn't been covered enough. She's also going to be joined by Lori Nelson. She's an official at the Boston Housing Authority. She's going to be a first vice president. She beat out Diane Wilkerson, the former state senator who was jailed on bribery charges. Diane Wilkerson lost by 11 votes. So very interesting. Obviously, Michael Curry, the outgoing prez, very much a active presence here in the Boston area.
Yeah.
And it will be interesting to see how Tanisha Sullivan continues that.
Absolutely. It's good hubbub. All right. So, you know, my hubbubs tend to range either about tech or animals. So like science or animals. Today, it's more in the science realm. But I have to give a giant hat tip to Beth Tytel because my hubbub is really just a quote from her story today. The bottom of the front page of the Globe, because she talked to a CEO of Cambridge-based Newtonomy. They're a self-driving car company. They're designing self-driving cars. And the CEO told her that, hey, you know, it's important for automated cars to be able to drive in human-like fashion. And that does mean adapting to the driving patterns around you, which, of course, in Greater Boston presents its own challenges. I always wondered if the driving was just too aggressive and random and possibly would require too many computations from a car and they couldn't function. But Beth takes it a step further and says, so this is a quote from her story. So does that mean our automated cars, will they be designed to tailgate or to make left turns from the right lane? And come winter, will they slash the tires of the car that has parked in a space they've shoveled? So the future of self-driving vehicles in Boston might be a little more aggressive than
That's a complicated algorithm, isn't it?
It is.
Will they know when I'm yelling at them?
Probably. Zuri Berry, Deputy Managing Editor for News and Multimedia at the Boston Herald and co-host of Newsfeed on Boston Herald Radio. Great to have you. Thank you so much. And John Carroll, Professor of Communications at Boston University and WBUR Senior News Analyst. Thank you as well.
Thanks.
Have a great weekend, gentlemen.
You too.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.